Thanks for downloading the Admin podcast. Al here with a quick note. After we recorded this episode, I listened back to it and noticed that I was saying log files where I meant to say transaction logs, so please bear that in mind. Welcome to the Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. You're a sysadmin working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy. So here we are, episode 3. We've made it this far. In fact, we've made it far enough to actually get some feedback, some emails from some of our adoring fans out there. Let's have a look, see who's wrote in. Right, we've had a message from Simon. Now he says it's really good. There's no other server podcast like it. It's relevant to what I do, and you're British, and I, like Andy, sorry, read that wrong there. It works well with him asking you stuff, and he asks the right questions. And like you, Al, he talks about real-world examples. Well, that's what we're going for as well, isn't it? We're going for some real-world examples.
Yeah.
Which is good because that helps everybody else. We've also had one from Al, Al Reed. And he said, really enjoyed the first episode. Good job, guys. I think it'll be really good as you build experience and confidence. You guys have a good balance and a good... and could make a well-rounded show. So that's another good one, so thanks for that, Al. And we've also had one from Josh. He says, agreed, good job, guys. You could even cut back on the amount of info, lots of content. Well, are we giving too much info out there, are we, do you think?
maybe. Yeah, so we've got the I've got the RSS feed working for the podcast, and I had some people saying it works, and we finally got on iTunes yesterday as well. So
yeah, that's right. You can now find us on iTunes. What can they do to find us on iTunes? Just search for Admin Podcast or something along those lines.
Yep, and I'm hoping that
you'll
people
find us pretty easy.
I'm hoping if people Google or search for servers or networking, we come up when we get back, when we get more and more audience. So so I thought this week we'd talk about Exchange. I know that you had an issue with one of your customers, which I helped you out with a couple of weeks ago, Andy. So I thought we'd go through what is Exchange, and because I mean you were talking about it and you wanted to know some more about it, didn't you, really?
That's right, yes. I mean, I think this podcast is basically going to be you because it's one of those things and like a lot of people, and this is where people are going to find it interesting because like a lot of people, they haven't delved into it too much. They haven't had experience with it. I think we know roughly how it's supposed to work and how the emails come in and they get distributed between the particular users on the local domain, but how does it actually work? It's not just a simple case of the postman delivers a letter and it ends up on your desk. It's a bit more of a process that it goes through, and a lot of settings and configurations that you can do. So personally, at that level of detail, I haven't got a clue. So over to you.
All right, then. So I thought we'd start off by saying what exactly is Exchange. So Exchange is kind of an email system, but it's not like your normal POP3 or IMAP system. I mean, the best thing about Exchange is that all the data is stored on the server. So it's not like where you've got Outlook and you've got all your emails stored in a PST file on your local computer. So if your computer has a hard drive failure or something, or if those files get corrupt, you then lose your emails. I mean, I know you can configure POP3 to keep the email on the server and then download a copy to your desktop. and then okay, you can then re-download it if you need to. But it just means you can have all your emails stored in one place. I mean, you also get instant email if you're connected to a network. So if people are emailing you internally, it will get to you as soon as the email's been sent. You will receive that. You also get things like calendars. You can also do things like free busy information and scheduling. So you can, if you've got the permission to, or if you set it so that people can see what you're up to. So you could, it won't actually tell you what you're actually doing, but it'll tell you if you try and book a meeting with yourself with a person, it will tell you if they're busy or not. So that's quite good. You can also, things, the good thing about calendars is that you can schedule meetings, and you can actually invite people, and then people can come and say, yes, I can join it, or I can't join it, or schedule it, or suggest another time. You can also add things like resource rooms, which basically means like you could have a meeting room, and when you do that calendar invite to everyone, you can schedule it for a room, so you book that room so no one else books that room. You can also things like have resource items, so like projectors and stuff, so for that. You can also access other people's mailboxes and sharing. So say like if you had a secretary, you can do it so that the secretary can see the MD's mailbox or his calendar and make appointments for him. You can do things as well, like you can do send as permissions, so that if you wanted to, you could send emails on behalf of the MD if you wanted to send an announcement out. You get interesting things like global address lists and books, so that you can have a big address book, so you can send people. So you have a company directory, so people can email, you can go in there and find people. It's quite good. You can find, it stores the information. If you put all the information, it can show you telephone numbers, who the manager is, and who reports to you. The good thing about Exchange is it can be accessed anywhere. It's got an internet connection. Obviously, you can use Outlook to connect to it when you're in the office, but you've got things like OWA. With things like Office with Exchange 2013, it's nearly using the actual OWA, which is basically Outlook Web Access, which is like an internet version of Outlook. It's nearly the same as Office. So wherever we go to a web browser, even if like Chrome or Firefox, you can put your OWA address, and you go in there and you get access to your mail. All you've got to put is your username and password in, you get access to your emails, set things like out of office. And you get things like a thing called ActiveSync, which is basically the thing which connects your mobile phone to the Exchange server. So you can things like sync your calendar and contacts. So like me, I have all my emails and contacts synced to Exchange, so that if I ever lose my phone or anything, I know all my contacts are backed up. So that's basically what Exchange can do. So where is Exchange come from? Well, started in the first edition Exchange Server 4 was introduced in 1996, which was a upgrade of the old MS Mail days, which is like a mail system back in the day, which used a system called X400 to deliver emails between the clients. In those days, there was no SMTP email support, which is basically the way how mail is transferred between email server. The first real edition was Exchange 5, which was introduced in 1997, which came with SMTP support and came along with the first edition of OWA, so you could actually, in version 5, you could actually access your email by a web browser. With 5.5 came along, they started giving you editions, so you get a standard and an enterprise edition, so depending on how much mail you could store in it. So the normal edition, you could have amazing, you could store up to 16 gigabytes worth of mail. With the enterprise, they said it could support up to 16 terabytes, but they recommend that you only have about 100 gig per server. So with the old Exchange 5.5 servers, with the old NT4 days, there was no integration between AD, well, there's no AD in the NT4 with the domain and the email system. So all Exchange was stored, all those emails and all the user settings were all stored in the Exchange administrator. and then you just attach that mailbox to a user. So coming along a bit, we had Exchange 2000, which was introduced in the year 2000, surprisingly enough, with Active Directory when Windows 2000 came out, and it was all part of the same thing. So in AD users of computers, you'd go in there and you'd actually configure people's email addresses actually inside AD users of computers. And there was a system manager, which was basically for a system configuration. So if you wanted to add new email domains, administer the kind of things like storage groups, databases, public folders, that was all done through the system manager. Then 2003 came out, and it was designed to make easier migration from Exchange 5.5, and again it gave you more space. And again, you had the two separate things, so all the user settings, email addresses, permissions were set in AD using computers, and then all the other settings were done in the system manager. In 2007, they went backwards, and well, not go backwards, they went back to an EMC, which is the Exchange Management Console. So it was still integrated in AD, but anything like the username, so not usernames, but adding email addresses, distribution lists, all things like that were all put back into the Exchange Management Console. So everything is back in one place where you did thing, you do your domain configuration was all done in the same place. In 2007, they built in a spam filter, and again, we had the next version, which was Exchange 2010, which gave us better high availability features. And it also introduced a thing called EPC, which is the Exchange Control Panel, which is kind of the first way of administrating Exchange through a web browser. Then there came along Exchange 2013, which is all web-based. So that's where we are today with Exchange 2013. With Exchange 2013. Again, you still get the different versions. You get standard and Exchange. And there are just different limitations between the two. So how do you connect to Exchange? Well, you use a client called Outlook, which is normally part of the Office suite, and it normally you connect to this thing called Mappy, an RPC, which, if any of you know used before, it uses many ports to connect to, and doesn't really work well over a wide area network. So within 2003, they introduced a thing called Exchange 2003. RPC over HTTPS or HTTP. It basically means that you only have to open one port on your firewall to actually get it to work. So what you can do is you can actually be sitting at home using your Outlook, and it connects back to your head office, not even using a VPN. It connects over HTTPS back into the Exchange server, and then you've got your full, it's like using Exchange in the office. So that's called Outlook Anywhere. So, in Exchange, there's a number of parts to it. So, I'm going to basically just focus anything above 2007, really, because there's not too many 2003 Exchange servers out there. I mean, there's still quite a few, but I sort of basically talk about 2007. So, 2007, there is three main roles you get. You get the hub role, the CAS role, and the mailbox role. So, the hub role is where all the mail rules go, or the mail filtering, where things like that happen. So what you do is that's where with your MX records you'd point your mail to forward all your, so your MX records you'd point to your hub transport server, and this is where it decides to send all your mail to. So if you have multiple Exchange servers, it knows where users are. So if it's like Al was on Exchange 1 and Andy was on Exchange 2, and an email came in to Al and Andy, it would know how to send the emails from... It would know to send an email where Al was, so you'd send it to my mail on the Exchange 1 server, and it'd send the mail to Andy onto Exchange 2 server. And again... the hub transport or the hub role also is designed to the sending out the email. So when you send email out, that's where the email will be sent from. So when you send an email to someone, say to Microsoft or Google, you send an email in Outlook, it would send it off, and depending on what rules you've got set on your hub transport server, that sends an email out. So you could have it configured so that it sends out by DNS, or you could send it out by going to a smart host like to your ISP, or if you subscribe to a service. So you can define things. Like, you could say that if it's from this certain domain, use DNS, or send it through a certain smart host, and for all the rest of the emails, send it through SMTP using DNS. So that's hub transport.
Okay. Well, so far it's kind of mind blowing, really, how much Exchange/Outlook. Because that's what most people would use. Here's one question, though. Can you use another client apart from Outlook? Or is it just easy to use Outlook? Or do other ones work?
No, it has to be a mappy client. And the main ones that work are the Exchange, because it's kind of priority. I mean, you can use POP3, because you would Exchange, you can configure with POP3 and IMAP. You can configure like Thunderbird or Outlook Express. But then again, you don't get anything like the calendar integration with that.
That's right, yeah, because when you use, I mean, everyone's familiar with using POP. We all like popping it, an IMAP. So everyone's familiar with that, but they are purely email transportation servers, aren't they? Just using one particular port number, 25 or... what's the other one? 110 and 465, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But of course, Exchange. How many port numbers does Exchange use roughly?
Well, with email flowing through, it was 25. But what I was saying about RPC, it uses mapping. RPC uses, it just uses random port numbers.
Okay.
And that was the problem. And that's why they've introduced Outlook Anywhere. So that you can have this RPC over HTTP, so that you only have to use one port. The next role is the which is a client access role, which is basically that's what your Exchange, what your Outlook or your mobile phone or your OWA goes to. So that would hit that, and then that would forward the request to the mailbox role. The mailbox role is where all your mail is stored. Okay, so you, when it gets to the mailbox role, stores all your emails. It stores in a thing called databases, Exchange databases, and these come in two parts. When the mail comes in to the Exchange database, it's actually stored in log files first, and then when it's been committed, when it knows it receives it, receives it on the log, it writes it to the log files. And then it writes it to the Exchange database files, okay? Once it's been written to the Exchange database files, it marks in the log files that it's been written to the database. So it just means that if you have any database corruptions or anything, you can roll back. So it's quicker to write to a log file, because what you'd normally do is put your log files on the faster drive speed. And what they recommend is that you have your log files in Exchange files on the same on different drives, because what can happen if after every backup you can tell Exchange to delete its logs, so because obviously it's taking up double the space because it's obviously written it in two places. So once the backup's finished, the log files get truncated so that the space can be freed up. But the problem you can get is if the backup's been failing, the log files don't get cleared down. So if the log, if the Exchange, if the drive, if the log files and the mailbox files on the same drive, you can fill the whole drive up and then you can corrupt the database because there's no space for it to write to. And it's quicker if on separate drives, you can easily more expand the drive quicker. So yeah, we always recommend that you have the log files and Exchange database files on separate drives. Okay.
This reminds me of our previous show, doesn't it, where we've gone on about log files and diagnostics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they're the kind of log files that you could you use those log files to do any diagnostic?
No, they're not. They're separate. Two different. They're different things. So you couldn't actually go inside them and look and say, "Oh, it tells you wrong." What happens is it writes the information. So when an email comes in to me, let's say, it writes it to the log file first, okay? It writes that email to the log file. It then can then write that file to the Exchange database, okay? So it first of all, every email that comes in, it keeps writing it to the log files, and then it writes it to the... Then it commits it to the database file. So this means you've got two places to write the file, sorry, the email to, so that if you ever get any corruption or anything, what you can do is you can restore your database from the night's backup, and because you've got log files from all that day since the last backup, you could then replay those logs back into that database file, so you wouldn't lose any emails. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, and it's a good idea, a good way of doing it. So two
separate
drives,
it's the same.
Completely, yeah.
It's the same in SQL. The SQL does the same thing. Data is quicker to write data into these small log files than it is trying to write into a massive file. So these Exchange database files are part of an Exchange called storage groups. It just means that you can have bigger. The problem you have with the smaller Exchange the old Exchange servers is that it's a database. Like in Exchange 2003, the limit on the database was 75 gig. So you would have to, so obviously that's quite not a lot on these days, but you could only have, so let's say that 10 people had 7.5 gig Exchange mailboxes, that's going to fill that whole database up, and then obviously you can't add any more in, or no one can have any more mail. So what you do is you split the users up into, you'd create a second database, so you'd have two databases, and obviously then people can have more mail. So that was the reason for storage groups. So like in Exchange 2003, you can have two databases in one storage groups, okay? And with 2007, like the database limit is like 16 terabytes per data store, and you can have 50 storage groups within 50 databases in each of those storage groups, okay? But you wouldn't have that because of what you want to keep those databases quite small because the recovery time. So if you have any issues and you have to I've had this in the past where we had data corruption, where we had issues on the actual physical disks, you only have to restore little databases. If you've got to restore a 500 gig database, it's going to take hours. But if you only got to store a 50 gig database, it's going to be a lot quicker.
I can imagine.
So yeah, so that's why you'd have smaller storage groups. But depending on if you've got standard enterprise, there's just different numbers of storage groups and how many databases you can have in there and what the database limit is. So with the Exchange Hub, CAS, mailboxes, roles, that's all Exchange 2007, 2010. In 2013, they have shrunk that there's only two roles, so you get a CAS role and a mailbox role. So the CAS role now is all your things like your people connecting by IWA, ActiveSync, and your email clients, okay? But that also now includes the SMTP rules and things like that. So all your mail transport rules, that's all done on the CAS role. And again, the mailbox role is just all the database, where all the database is installed. accounts. But with Exchange 2013 as well, you get, they don't use MAPI anymore. They use MAPI over HTTP. So it's all now done over one port. So there's no longer this issue with mapping the actual port numbers. So there's a couple of services you want to remember if you do have issues with Exchange. There's two Exchange services. Make Microsoft System Attendant Service. This is the most, well, one is the important one. Is that one controls who can connect, how you connect to the information store. So it does things like if your Outlook client comes to a server and it says, "Where's my day's mail?" That basically tells you where to go. So that the SA needs to be started all the time. And the Microsoft Exchange Information Store service, that needs to be started as well, because that basically just controls the databases. And that makes sure mounts that the database mounts. Normally, if that service won't start, it normally means you've got issues with your database, you're corrupt. But again, if you looked on your system logs in the event viewer, it will tell you about those files. So that's really my kind of overall of Exchange, really. You've got any questions?
Well, where do I start? It's certainly I'm kind of blown away in one respect to how much it's changed over the years, and how especially with, I suppose the biggest change has been the 2013 version, I would imagine, with it all going being web based. That's the biggest thing. But yeah, it's such a huge program, isn't it? It's a huge even for the first things you were saying about with, you know, there's calendars and there's schedules and there's, it's basically a huge office tool, isn't it? And some of the clients that I've had have been using it, you know, use it in those kind of ways that you've described about calendars, booking appointments for people, being able to see emails from different people. Maybe one person has, for example, John at company.com, but they also look after sales at company.com, so they have to be able to access two addresses, both within the same version of Outlook, and be able to send from each different email address. And of course all this is done from one location, isn't it, on the server. All this can be set up on the server itself, can't it? You don't have to go to the client's desk to do any of this. It's all done from one location. So it's even from listening to you doing this now, it's an awful lot bigger, complex, but also customizable as well. You know, it really does sound very customizable. You could really tune it into whatever the customer's needs are.
I mean, it's such a big product. I mean, it's really lots. You can do so much with it. It's trying to hard to think. I'm trying to work today, trying to think how it actually works and what it actually does. I mean, when an email comes in, it knows where all the email addresses are, what mailboxes got what email addresses, what distribution lists have got what email addresses, who's a member of those groups, how it all sends it all out. It's just it's mind-blowing. I mean, I've been using it for the last 10 years and I still feel like I'm not really that much of an expert on it. The one thing I didn't forget to mention, with 2007, it introduced PowerShell, and a lot of the features now you have to configure via the PowerShell. One of my headaches this week, I've been doing an Office 365 migration. The customer I'm currently working on they currently got Exchange 2003 at two sites, and not very good ADSL connection. They've got two ADSL, an ADSL connection each side, and they've got a not very good VPN connection between the two. And we were looking at ways of how we could migrate it to the cloud. I mean, there's a number of products you can buy to do it called Migration Wizard, which is basically a website where you point it to your old Exchange server and to Office 365, and it does all the migration for you. So, but we couldn't really use that because they haven't got enough bandwidth for the site. So what we did for them is, so what Office 365 is, if anyone doesn't know what it is, it's basically Exchange 2013 in the cloud, which is really, it's a good pricing. It's like £9 in the UK. It's £9 per user for this one we are doing, per user per month. And that user gets you get 50 gigs worth of space. You also get the latest version of Office as well. So you get what you pay your monthly £9 per month. And every month, if there's a new version of Outlook Office comes out, you get that. You can easily get rights to upgrade to that. So what happens is we set everything up for them, and we basically had to go to each of the machine and export all their mail to a PST file, and then go back to our office because we've got a better internet connection, and then import the emails back in. Right. And and we had an issue today with the that someone had set up a folder at the start of the week because they weren't going to be in the office, and she didn't bother telling us this. But what happened is that she was then. The man who she forwarded the email was moaning that when she got back in the office that she was still receiving the emails. So she had disabled the because there's a thing called out of office where if someone emails you, it basically replies and said, "Hey, I'm sorry, not in my office. You can do this or whatever." But you can also say that it forwards you an email to someone else. And this is what she had done, but she hadn't told me this. But she then said, "The emails keep going. This guy keeps doing emails." So I said, "All right then. So have you got any rules?" She goes, no, there's no rules." So I dialed into her Outlook, had no rules in there. No, definitely an OWA as well, because that's what it might have been then. Looked into the Exchange settings, because you can go to, basically with Office 365, you get access to the ECP website, which is Exchange's control panel. The way of administering Exchange 2013, and I couldn't see anywhere on that user any forwards. So I had to use a PowerShell. A lot of things you have to do PowerShell, so you have to bring up a PowerShell command and connect to the Office 365. And you run this command, I'll put it in the show notes, and it showed that she had a mail forwarding to this other man. So I had to run a PowerShell to disable it. So I don't know when she turned off the auto reply. The out of office, it didn't obviously disable it in the background. So I don't know if that's a bug in Office 365, but I couldn't figure it out why she was getting, why this other man was getting emails. Because to confuse matters, we asked them where I basically, on the old Exchange 2003 server, I printed out a list of all the email addresses being used, and I sent them to the customer and say, "What do you want? Where do you want? Are you happy with these email addresses?" And they said, "Oh yeah, but we want to change this person to receive all the info at mailboxes." So this was all pointed to this lady. But then this week said, "Oh no, we don't want it to go to this other guy." So I had to remove the email addresses from one account and then put it to the second account. And I thought maybe I'd moved her email address, but I know in Exchange you can only have one email address in one place. So it just got really confusing. So I'll put the notes in the show notes for that.
So okay, that leads on to the use of PST files and OST files. There I know one of them is an offline storage file. So where does that come into Exchange OST and PST files, and does it come into it now with Outlook 2013 on the web, or is it purely 0313?
No, it's still being used with Exchange. It's nothing to do with OWA, but with the Outlook client, if you wanted to have basically a PST is like, if you've got your emails like your POP3 or whatever, you want to have a local storage in a local machine, that's what a PST file is for. So you set your POP3 and it delivers your mail locally into your machine. So PST is nothing really for to be used with Exchange. The only reason I'm using Exchange PST in my migration is that you've got to export it somewhere, so you have to pull it out of Exchange, put it into a PST file, and then you can import that PST file back into the new Exchange you then reconfigure the client to point to the Exchange 2013 server, and then you, once it's all configured, you can then re-import the mail in.
Okay. Right, so yeah, so you wouldn't run PST files and a PST file on the local computer and on Exchange generally.
No, the only reason you'd do that, if you wanted to export it or if you wanted to archive out of Exchange, I mean, with the limits of the old Exchange, people used to archive emails out, but with the storage you can get, and how storage cheaper, you want to keep it all inside Exchange these days. I mean, with the other products you can get, like the archiving solutions, it's there's no point of having a PSTs. With OSTs, are offline files, so when you set up it at the to use cache mode, it stores all its mails. When it downloads the mail onto your PC into Outlook, it stores those mails in the OST file. So if your server goes down or you're on a train with no network connection, you can still have access to your local mail.
Do you run OST files by default?
Depends. If it's on a terminal server, never run an OST file, but we enable it most, because if, say, the network goes down or the internet goes down or the Exchange server goes offline, you've still got access to your old emails.
So that basically means, yeah, you can basically, if the user at the machine then may not even know that the internet's gone down or the network's gone down, if they sent an email on the local machine and the internet was down, they just hit send and it would go. Of course, in reality, it wouldn't go, would it? Because the internet's down.
Yeah,
but
it would go.
When the internet come back up again, then it would go again. So the user at the end doesn't know anything's happened.
Yeah, it will go into your outbox and sit in your outbox until it goes to the sent items. So it will sit in your outbox, and then when the internet connection comes back, it will go into your sent items.
And then it will go. So there's two different uses of. So PSTs are mainly, so certainly if you have just a home Outlook, that's where you'd use pop email, and that would all be saved locally as a PST file. When you're on an Exchange server, you don't use PSTs at all, unless you're doing your exporting, like in that migration that you're doing. But that's where OST files come into it. What happens now with Exchange 2013 in the cloud? What happens with the OSTs and PSTs then?
Well, all it means is that your Exchange server's in the cloud. It doesn't make any difference at all. It just means with your one, because basically you get on-premise, which is the where you have your Exchange in the office. So that's where you have your physical server in the server, and then you've got in the cloud is where your mail is, where all your mail and everything is. The server is in the cloud, so your email will, you still have your OST file, but instead of connecting your Outlook to your local Exchange server, you just point it to the web. It uses this nice thing called auto discovery, which actually puts me onto my next thing. If you've ever been using anything with Exchange 2007 and certificate, auto discovery is a nightmare. Auto discovery is, what that does is, it when you put Outlook, open Outlook, I think anything above Exchange 2007, when you open your Outlook, it will go and speak to AD and it will auto configure your Exchange server. So in the old days of Exchange 2003 and Outlook 2003, to configure it, you'd open it up and it would ask you what your username was and what your Exchange server, and the user had to know that to configure them and get them into the Exchange. With Office 2007, Exchange 2007, you had a feature called Auto Discovery. So when you bring up your Outlook, it either queries AD and it says, "Oh, I know your email address and I know where the Exchange server is." So it does automatically configures the Exchange for you. So the first thing it does, it checks AD. If it can't check AD, it uses a DNS record to see where your Exchange server settings are. So, like with this Office 365, you have to set an MX record up, not an MX, sorry, an A record which is basically autodiscover dot whatever the email address, whatever their domain name is. So autodiscover.domain.co.uk, you do a change name, so it goes to, I think it's something like outlook.office365.com. So when you go into, when you're setting up all these people's emails up, you basically go into Outlook 2013, put your email address in and your password, and it goes off and obviously looks at what your domain name is on your email address, and it looks at the DNS record, and it basically auto-configures it for you. So you don't have to do any configuration at all. It sets all the RPC up, or the Outlook anyway, up for you, and it's really easy to do. So there's not much configuration. I ran into a problem because we're basically part of this migration. We're replacing all the XP machines, because obviously the problem you get is that you can't buy anything other than Office 2013 anymore. You can buy downgrade rights, but you have to buy it with the Microsoft, I can't think what it's called now, it's called but it's like a subscription base, so you're just paying for the latest version, and that means that you can downgrade. So if you are going to PC World or whatever, and go on to Amazon or whatever, and you buy a copy of Office 2013 Home and Office version, you haven't got permission to downgrade that to an earlier version. So the problem you've got is that anything Office 2013 won't speak to Exchange 2003, and obviously if you buy a new PC, obviously this customer had Exchange 2003, all you can buy is Office. I think this pricing is like this thing from Microsoft is like double the price for a normal Office license. Oh, software assurance, that's what it's called. So you basically, you buy your product and then you pay a bit more, I think it's quite a lot more, and then you can run the latest, but also means you can run a downgraded version. So we were doing migration to actually replace their XP machines with Windows 7 machines, obviously the end of XP, and when we were replacing the Windows 7 machine, we were replacing them with a Windows 7 machine, and then you obviously with the cost of Office 365, you get a copy of Office 2013. The problem is we had everyone's, I said everyone used their own account's passwords up, except, so we could do them before we got on site, but when we got on site to deliver the kit, we didn't have one of the username and password for the users, because he's the guy who set up the account. And the problem is when we put the PC on the network and he went into Office 2013, Outlook 2013, it kept auto-discovering the domain and kept putting in the old Exchange server. So I remember Mike Tech on his show a couple of weeks ago saying he had to disable all the old Exchange services so that when Outlook came up, it wouldn't find the old Exchange server. The problem is that I couldn't do that because we were doing a slow migration and they still needed access to the old email server. So what we would do is when we were migrating them across to the new server, we were giving them access to the old server by the old WA address. So I found a nice little article which I'll put in the show notes, which basically tells you how to manually configure Office 365, because whenever you tried to manually put the settings in, which I thought you had to put in, it kept reconnecting to the old Exchange server. So I spent an hour hitting on my head on the table trying to work out why this, to manually configure this Outlook for Office 365.
Yeah, it's well there's a great example straight away though, where you had this problem and you remembered something that was said on the Mike Tech show, and it popped into your head and I give you a solution. So hopefully people listening to this podcast will get some information, and when they run into the problems with diagnostics or Exchange and whatever else we've talked about, they may think about our podcast too. but that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's sharing all this information out and spreading the word. So where are we up to now then? So we've covered
we covered main questions. I know there's two things I want left to talk about. One is the thing, I'll talk quickly about another issue I had the other week with Exchange, to see people know, And the other issue is obviously the issue I helped out with you, with your customer. So,
oh, yes, yeah.
I've been doing an exchange migration from this 2003 to 2010, and I had a problem that I set it all up, it's all working fine. We migrated the IT manager and a couple of the IT staff across, and everything was working fine. Started slowly migrating the users across. And then the IT manager phoned up and says, I can't send emails to certain people. I'm going, this is odd, I haven't come across it. So I dialed onto his machine, and it was saying, the error message was getting saying, cannot perform the requested operation, the command selected is not valid for the recipient. We finally worked out that it was that he was trying to send to distribution this, and it was just chucking his email, this message back. But what it was happening was that we found out that if you tried to expand the distribution list, because what you can do is when you send an email and Outlook, you can go to, and you say like to sales, you can actually double click on the sales name, it'll expand and show you all the users in that sales group. The problem was, is that he was running a multi-domain network, he had global groups. And apparently Exchange, I didn't know this, Exchange, after 2007, global groups cannot be used for distribution this. So when I went into Exchange 2000, the actual 2010 management console, to look at the actual, where the actual distribution lists were, I noticed that they were all greyed out. And a bit of Googling, I'll put again, in the show notes, I'll put the link to this website. And it shows you that you have to convert the global groups to universal groups. So there wasn't a problem because they weren't using, they didn't have any trust. So it was just a case of converting the groups from global groups to universal groups. So I did a test group first, created a new group with a global group in the old Exchange 2003, couldn't expand it from the Exchange 2010 server, converted to a universal group, could send to that mailbox straight away. So anyone come across that? I haven't had that problem with the number of Exchange 2010 migrations, the first one I came across. So
okay, so the other thing we had was that problem I had, wasn't it, with one of my clients. So this one really had two issues, and it goes back quite a way, at least the first one does. They basically have their network is running on the broadband, their ISP is giving them a dynamic IP address, which as you could probably imagine causes problems straight away, doesn't it? Most of the ones you're running on, I would imagine, have static IPs. Well, these are more of a charity organization. They don't have many users in it, so they only have a dynamic ISP provider. So as a result, in order for the for them to get the mail through the MX records, they have to use a DDNS, dynamic DNS. And they had that set up through dyn.com. First problem that they came across was they weren't getting any mail or sending any mail. And when I looked into it and I logged on to the dyn.com account, they were basically offline. It wasn't configured, so I had to reconfigure that DNS account again, and they were all working again. It turned out actually that a month later same problem reoccurred. Now I was unaware of this, and whether this was a more recent thing I'm not entirely sure, but the dyn.com, because they were only on a free account, they had to, or I had to, I suppose, had to re-register that it was something dot dyn.org, I think the address was, but you had to go and re-register that every 30 days, otherwise it would be deactivated. So since then they've actually purchased the premium version of dyn.com, so they're on a year subscription, so that shouldn't go off for the next year. So now the the DDNS doesn't go off and all her emails come through. However, that leads on to the second problem that they had, was not being able to... They basically could not send to certain email addresses. They could send to lots of people, but not everybody. And unfortunately, some of the other organizations that they were sending emails to were getting blocked. So this is one thing that... This is where I brought you into it, wasn't it, really? Because we had this situation where they could send an email to their personal Hotmail, they could send an email to the certain other companies that they use, but some of the other business people that they work a lot with, different governments and school websites and email addresses were getting blocked. And that's where I asked you, wasn't it, what could be causing this? Why are some email addresses getting blocked, and why are some of them going through? And then you came up with a great idea, didn't you?
Yeah, so you were telling me they weren't going, and I was saying, well, what message were they receiving? So you dialed onto their server and asked me, and basically got a bounce back. So you forwarded that bounce back to me, and I can't remember what it exactly said, but I think it said something like that your host is blacklisted or something along that lines.
That's right.
I've actually got the message here. It says here.
Okay, I'm looking for
server it. Unavailable. Can't host. Blocked using blacklist. Mail from IP banned. So what I did then was I thought, I know what this is. It's blacklisted. So obviously, maybe you got an open relay on your Exchange server. So what that means is that if you don't know what you're doing and you set your Exchange server up, people can email through your Exchange server. So people like spammers can use it to send emails out. So what the first thing I did, I checked that you want an open relay. So there's many websites out there which you can basically put their public IP address in, it will basically try the spammer and send the email address out. I did that, and again it said no, you're not an open relay, that's fine. So I thought, hang on a minute. So I bet there's sites you can look on the web and it basically tells you if you're blacklisted or not. So I basically put a number on that. So like, let's say the last digit was 195, I'd put 196 in it. And again, it was that IP address again was being blocked. It's saying it's blacklisted. So what looked like had happened is the whole subnet had been blacklisted. And this normally happens if you're like a home account, or it's like a home, a lot of home users are on there. So their mail was currently set to work for DNS. So when an email is sent from that user, from that site, it goes to DNS. So it uses DNS to go and look for who the MX record was. And then it sends that mail to that user. What I would recommend is that you send your email through an SMTP provider so that you haven't got to worry about being blacklisted. So, or if like we normally provide we provide mail filtering so that so when your mail comes in, it doesn't actually come to your Exchange server first. It goes via a spam filter and then this email forwards it to your Exchange server. The good thing about that, it means that you can lock your firewall down so that you know that all your mail is going to be coming from this one ISP or from your mail filter, and it means that people can't hack you. They'll try hacking your mail filter and not you. Also, part of the good service is you send your email out via them. It means that you haven't got to worry, and you haven't got to keep making sure you're not on blacklist, because that's all what they do. So what I got you to do is I got you to speak to the ISP and get the SMTP server, didn't I?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I phoned them up and it was a simple address. It was just SMTP dot... I can't remember what the ISP name, .co.uk it was. That's all they give us for that. And then we went into, where was it? In the, it was in the exchange transport hub, was it?
Yeah, so it's under organisation configuration, and this is Exchange 2007. And under hub transport, you get a thing called Send Connector. And if you go into that Send Connector, there's a thing that says address space. So you were saying any, so it's basically star, so it's basically any email address, basically send it out. So route mail through the following smart host, and you basically put the that relay or mail or whatever it's called, mail.btconnect.com or whatever in it, click OK, and now it will route all your email through that server.
So that takes the DNS out of it, doesn't it? So if any blacklist is affecting that IP range, or it bypasses that completely, because the ISPs don't want to be blacklisted, so then they are hopefully, of course, not going to be blacklisted. So
so the mail looks like it's coming from the ISP and not from you, so you haven't got to worry. Because I always have a problem with like addresses like AOL.com are always a nightmare to, if you're running your own email server, to they do quite a lot of checking. But they're all happy now, aren't they? You said they come back saying they're happy. So
I did a first test. I thought, right, I'm going to test this myself, because we did this, didn't we, kind of late one night, so remotely, which is a great thing about remote support, isn't it? You can do it in the middle of the night if you want. No one has to be there. I thought, okay, well, I found one of the email addresses that they were having problems sending to, or one of the domains that were having problems sending to. It was something.school.gov.uk, I think it was. So I thought, well, if I shoot them an email from the I was basically using the admin account on the server. If I shoot them an email now, then hopefully I won't get a bounce back message. And I think they were happening pretty quickly, you know, within, you know, a minute or so you were getting a bounce back message. So I sent an email off and got no bounce back whatsoever. So I thought, well, that's a fairly decent test. But when I went into the actual office the next day and I told the office workers in the, you know, that, you know, try and send some of these people some emails, because it wasn't just that one email address, they had problems sending it to several others as well. So I said, right, send them emails using your work email account, and see how you go. And when was that? That must have been a week ago or so now, is it, that we did that? A
couple of weeks.
About a week, yeah. I've spoke to them since that. I spoke to them the day after. They were still quite happy. I've spoke to them since then. The girl seemed to think everything was okay still. So, as you say, no feedback is good feedback. If it didn't work, I'd know about it by now. So, so that was a great successful test and a real world solution to an exchange problem. And it was actually one of the things that kind of gave us the idea of doing this show on Exchange, wasn't it? Just because that topic happened to come up. I thought, well, hang on, this could be a good thing to talk about. So so that's a good that was a good one. So so where are we up to now? I mean, we've covered a fair bit on it there, aren't we?
We've now come up to an hour, according to
nearly an hour already, yeah.
I think we can wrap up here, really, I think.
Yeah, so, that's no problem, yeah. There's nothing else you can think of.
No, I'm a bit, my throat's a bit dry for talking so much, so...
it's an hour of constant information there, so... not much else to say, but obviously now we've got the FeedBurner RSS feed working. So if you're not on that, then make sure you subscribe to us on that using your favorite podcast capture software, whatever you happen to use. And of course now we're on iTunes, aren't we, as well? So if you go and look for us in that, and you can get us subscribed on that as well. So how else can you get us? Well, you can get us on email as well, can't you? So mine is andy@admin.co.uk. And what's yours?
it's Al at abnabnpodcast.co.uk.
Okay. So any more feedback from the guys that have sent us some feedback already, so thanks for that. Any more feedback from anybody or any other show topics, show ideas, questions about what you've heard from us already, or any new topics that you want us to talk about, then let us know.
Yeah, I've got a request to do DNS next time, so how that works.
DNS, okay. So we may do that big on the next topic. Show. That's another big topic. So that's great. So it's goodbye from me. We'll see you all next time.
Yeah, goodbye. Have fun.